I saw it on Linden Street.
Hello, and welcome to I Saw It on Linden Street, the show dedicated to the joy of finding an appreciation in cult films, exploitation oddities, beloved classics, and all points in between. I'm your host, Chris Roberts, inviting you to join us here at the Linden Street Cinema Experience Theater as we once again dig up a fun cinematic relic from the past. If you're new to the show, thank you very much for joining us. This isn't your standard film review. Rather, it's going to be a synopsis of a film that we feel deserves to have another inspection. Some background thrown in on the actors, stories on the director, and hey, if I'm doing my job, perhaps you'll get a half-amusing story out of me. Now, fair be warned, we're not going to cover all aspects of the plot, but we do discuss endings and spoilers. So, if you'd like to be, quote, surprised, please give the film a viewing before you listen to us. If you like us, and I would hope that you do, please recommend this podcast to a friend, subscribe, give us a favorable review. It's July, it's hot, we're awkwardly sweating and sticking to this month's theme of RUN! That's our selection of some great classic films revolving all around getting the hell out of town. This week, we dig into Walter Hill's imaginative retelling of a classic Greek epic, using gangs in an alternate New York City. 1979's cult classic, The Warriors. Join us! So here's something funny. This week's film is actually one that I always kind of flirted with. I would walk by it, but I never actually sat down to watch it until I was well into my college years. Now, in hindsight, I had seen numerous parodies and references to it over the years, but I had never had the wherewithal to actually put it together. So here I am, one day in my college undergrad days, working at the library as a student worker, and my boss is holding court, talking movies, and everyone's having a good time, and as I just said, movies are being discussed. And the conversation meanders over to character actors, particularly David Patrick Kelly. And while we're talking about him, somebody standing around suddenly busts off the iconic line. Thus, when the laughter subsided, I needed to make a confession that drew true looks of incredulity, bordering on distaste, from these my film-loving co-workers. Guys, I've actually never seen The Warriors. Now, to your average run-of-the-mill Joe on the street, that may be a perfectly reasonable thing to say nowadays, especially since we're a good 41 years on since its release, and couple that with the fact that the kids these days don't really watch anything that happened, before now. It's pretty much the norm. But there I was, a self-proclaimed movie fan, who had volunteered to be jumped into a larger gang of movie fans. I may as well have just admitted to them that I found the hearts of babies to be toothsome and flavorful. There was some, a lot of ribbing done at my expense, but at least I had the wherewithal to apologize for never making the effort to see it prior. And thus, I flat out just asked them, well, what exactly is The Warriors about? My boss ended up fidgeting around with the Tallywargan. That's what we kept in the inner office. It's an old-school click counter, and we used it to shelf-read and report irregularities. He took a beat, and then he gave one of the most truthful and laconic of answers that actually perfectly fit this film. Hey, it's just about a bunch of guys trying to get home. I looked around, and I saw just a bunch of somber faces nodding in agreement, and that's when I decided, wow, I really need to remedy this faux pas quickly. So, on the way home, I hit the video store after my shift ended, and by the end of the evening, I was screening The Warriors in my dorm room for a few friends. And we took in this very stylized, very ahead of its time, interpretation of gang life in an alternate New York City. Now, in theory, it has everything on the surface that I would love initially. You have Walter Hill directing. You have a Lawrence Gordon script. You have a great cast of character actors. And all of it is based on a pulp novel written by Saul Urich in the mid-1960s, which itself was inspired by the writings of a Greek historian, Xenophon. His great work, The Anabasis, which covers the later days of the Peloponnesian War and talks about a stranded Greek army of mercenaries. What? You're not familiar with that one? That's all right. I mean, oh no? Do you hear that? It sounds like a history lesson's coming this way. Allow me to now bore you with some literal ancient history. You see, our story this week has its roots in a civil war that gripped the Achaemenid dynasty of the Persian Empire in the latter days of the larger ongoing Peloponnesian War that raged across the Mediterranean, with the primary conflict focused on dominance of the Aegean Sea around 414 years BCE. At the time, the Persians were ruled by Darius II, who was waging war on and off with the city-states of both Athens and Sparta. At the time of his death in 405 BCE, his younger son, Cyrus the Younger, a decorated general, and at the time, the satrap of Asia Minor. That means he's a regional governor. He was a well-respected and liked ruler within the Persian Empire. He was greatly favored by the queen mother, Parysatis, to take over when his father died. Despite all of this, Darius II ended up decreeing that it would be his eldest son, Arsamas, who would inherit the throne, who was, by all accounts, not really the man that Cyrus was. Cyrus, though, made his claim of legitimacy to the throne known, stating that his brother was born when his father was not a ruler of the empire, and thus his own lineage and claims to being the son of the king were true, and then he cited the fact that he himself was ruling the westernmost state of the empire already. Arsamas actually wanted to settle things with his brother using diplomacy, but he found handling the matter that way to be very difficult, as the situation was turned all the more complex by the interference of another Asian Minor regional governor, Tissaphernes, who himself was the satrap of Caria. He was both jealous of Cyrus's control over the region next to his, and he wanted to ingratiate himself with the new king. Tissaphernes ended up accusing Cyrus of an open revolt against his brother. He cited the general's loyal troops, who were amassing in his own home region, as well as these favorable relations that Cyrus had with foreign Spartan forces. Now, let me interrupt my own train of thought on this lesson here. You see, 3 years prior, in 408 BCE, on behalf of his father, Darius, Cyrus ended up entering into an agreement with the Spartan general Lysander, a man who himself wanted to unify all of Greece, of course under his and Spartan control, and he saw in Cyrus a kindred spirit. Striking a deal to help control those pesky Athenians from interfering with more Persian affairs in the region, the Persian Empire would end up backing Lysander in his campaigns to keep those warring philosophers in check. And in return, the general would then owe the Persians a favor. Cyrus gave him troops, supplies, and when his father ended up calling him back to Babylon to tend to him on his deathbed, Cyrus ended up giving the general his entire war chest to continue the fight in his absence, which did help the Spartans maintain and expand their control over the peninsula. It was this relationship that was met with suspicion from Tissaphernes, and one that he exploited for his own gain. So upon taking the throne, Arsames ended up renaming himself Artaxerxes II, which was a nod to his grandfather. And on this first word of trouble that came in from Tissaphernes, he had his younger brother arrested for inciting a revolt. Except here's the problem. at this point in time, Cyrus really hadn't done anything other than lodge the complaint that he felt he should be on the throne, with intervention from their mother, Paracelsus. Artaxerxes released Cyrus with a full pardon and sent him back to Asia Minor to continue his governance there. So, what is a spurned, accused, well-armed, hot-headed younger sibling to do? Well, like so many things in life, Cyrus seemed to take the lesson away from all of this that, you know what, if you're going to arrest me and call me a traitor, I might as well actually be one. Returning to his stronghold of Lydia in western Anatolia, that would now be modern Turkey, Cyrus decided that it was time to call in that favor from Lysander and request some, quote, help. Spring, 401 BCE. Announcing again his rightful claim to the Persian throne, Cyrus was gifted 35 Spartan triremes loaded with over 700 Spartan warriors, 2,500 Peltas troops from Thrace, and 10,400 Greek hoplites, or as they like to call themselves, the 10,000. And he was able to raise another 10,000 of his own Persian troops from the local city supporters. The Greek mercenaries who were there grumbled about being so far from home, not actually completely comfortable with their objectives. They were to cross all of Asia Minor to try to seize the capital of Babylon, which is now considered to be modern Iraq. As Xenophon himself wrote, the Spartan general Clearchus was not a fan of this campaign, nor was he enamored with Cyrus, but the Greek soldiers who were fighting on his behalf actually thought quite highly of the Persian, and how he would actually soldier on with the men himself. By October of that year, they had traveled without much resistance throughout the empire, and they were now stopped dead on the banks of the Euphrates River. Some 24,000 mercenaries and Cyrus loyalists standing across from over 40,000 Persian warriors led by Artaxerxes II. Cyrus knew he had to break his brother here, and he launched a full-out assault on the Persian forces in what would become the Battle of Cunaxa. Cyrus took his main force to bear against his brothers, ordering the Greek forces who were flanking him to join him, folding in on the center column, an order that General Clearchus ignored. Instead, the mercenary general charged the Persian flanks, breaking their lines, routing a superior force of Persians with very few Greek casualties. The Greeks loved it. They were winning. What's the problem? Well, here's the thing. When the quarterback tells you you need to block for him, he means it. Running backs that make it all the way to the end zone will have nothing to show for it if there's nobody left standing to throw the ball. Accounts do vary. He may have been knocked off his horse, he may have hit his head, he might have gotten darted, then tripped, then received a final blow, or even a popular account says he was directly speared by a javelin. No matter how you slice it, the results were the same. Cyrus was killed on the banks of the Euphrates, and the insurgency itself was over. Except now you have an army of Greeks hanging out in the middle of the Persian Empire. Artaxerxes went back to Babylon, and he left this as a problem to be dealt with by Tissaphernes. The Greeks actually offered their services to the governor, but he declined. Yet he was equally put out by the fact that he just couldn't, you know, leave them here. They wouldn't surrender to him, so what he did was, fine, I'm just going to help escort you home. So Tissaphernes ends up taking his forces, and he leads this Greek army out and away from the capital, back across half of Asia Minor. It's here that he deceitfully offered them up a feast, and General Clearchus and his officers, being sort of foolish, took him up on it. The men joined him for a meal, and that's exactly when the governor had them all arrested. He shipped them back to King Artaxerxes, where they were all beheaded as examples of getting in the way of the empire. The remaining 10,000, as they had taken to call themselves, elected leaders from amongst their junior officer ranks, and Xenophon himself was one that was elevated up to lead. He ended up taking his men on a painfully slow retreat to the northwest, battling Persian forces ahead of them as they went, and hounded by Tissaphernes' forces who would harass his rear column, all the while dealing with the very real logistical troubles of having to feed and move 10,000 men not at all equipped for an Anatolian winter. Xenophon himself had real ingenuity. He would wheel and deal where he could, he would bluff his way through situations, and when he couldn't get away with doing any of that, he would straight up fight his way through hostile areas. As they went, they would conquer and raise areas to resupply themselves, always trying to stay a step ahead of their pursuers. In the following year, the spring of 399 BCE, the 10,000 actually had been reduced to a force of only about 6,000 due to attrition and lack of resources. It's then that they crested Mount Thaçis, now known as Mount Mador in Turkey, and they joyfully began to celebrate because they could see the coastline finally, crying out, "The sea, the sea." Now that they were beyond control of the Persians in Asia Minor, they had made their way back to friendly Greek city-states, and after a few more minor exploits among their countrymen, the survivors ended up sailing back to Greece, and Xenophon wrote of all of their adventures in his story, his Anabasis. Oh, it's not really germane, but if you're like me, you don't like loose ends, so let me just close this history lesson with this. Artaxerxes II would go on to have a long but somewhat troubled reign. He would sit on the throne for the next 46 years, spending most of his time trying to consolidate and rule his empire and contend with uprisings in Egypt and then another uprising amongst his own satraps, never quite happy with his task, dealing with problems of intrigue in his own house, which were mainly caused by his mother and his own wife. That Spartan general, Lysander, he had wanted to join Cyrus in his campaign against Artaxerxes, but he was kept back and sent off to fight campaigns against Athens. Some think this was a way to control his ambitions and keep him in check with the other Spartan kings. Hence, they sent Clearchus in his stead. He would never get to live to see a conquered, unified Greece under his own banner, nor would he get to make a play for the throne, as he himself was killed at the Battle of Halartus in 395 BCE. Oh, and one more thing. That same year, 395 BCE, the duplicitous satrap Tissaphernes had finally reached the end of his rope. Blamed by the queen mother, Perisaitis, for the death of her favorite son, and reasoning that he had exacerbated the royal dispute between the two brothers for his own gain, she ended up sending assassins to finish the job that Cyrus had started, and he was murdered in his home in Colossae. Ain't history grand, folks? So Saul Urich writes a pulp novel about a gang of black and Hispanic teens living in Coney Island, New York City, known as the Dominators, who congregate with other gangs around the city to meet for a peace summit in the Bronx to discuss a grand truce that will put them all together against the forces of, quote, the man, allowing them to take over the entire city by working together. The idea itself is well received, but some of the gangs begin fighting, and the meeting turns into a general brawl, where the organizer is killed and the police arrive in droves. The rest of the story itself is about how the Dominators are attempting to navigate their way home through hostile territory, avoiding both law enforcement, other gangs, and just general dangerous parts of the city. As a novel, it's gritty, it's violent, and it has some very disturbing moments, where the boys end up competing with each other through tests of their manhood. Tests that include risking life and limb. Tests that include murder. Tests that include assaulting women. It's controversial, it's upsetting, but it sold fairly well. I ended up reading a copy of myself when I was on a desk shift one evening. I mean, it's no Shakespeare, but it'll do. So you see, back in 1978, producer Lawrence Gordon, he had gotten the rights to Urich's novel, and he ended up hiring screenwriter David Schaber to put together a loose script for him. Having previously worked with Hill on past projects, including Hard Times in 1975 and The Great The Driver in 1978, Gordon actually thought this would be right up Hill's alley. In hindsight, it completely was, but at the time, Hill was skeptical that he would actually be able to get it made. After all, story about minority gangs fighting way across New York City? It doesn't exactly sound like mainstream material. In his own words, Hill felt it was too extreme, too weird of a concept to try to pitch to a studio. But as luck would have it, Paramount was trying at the time to release more films aimed at teens. And actually, to the surprise of Gordon and Hill, they were quite eager to pick up the project and finance it. So the film would be made on the cheap, but as far as Hill was concerned, he didn't really need much. It was greenlit for the spring of 1978. The Warriors was going to be heading to the big screen, but with some hard caveats from the studio. First, the film had to be made, quote, more commercial, which meant they were going to have a multi-ethnic gang. It was going to be black, Hispanic, and white, as opposed to the novel, where the gang was comprised of only minority characters. Right or wrong, that edict came down from the studio, and Hill went with it. Next, they had to get the film out on a very tight schedule. You see, Warner Brothers at the time was releasing their own, quote, gang picture, although it was completely different. The Wanderers, it was set in the 60s, it was a comedy, it was a greaser-style picture. That was slated for the release of the summer of 1979. Paramount wanted to beat them to the punch, so this was a film that had to be done for a spring of 79 released. Casting. Hill ended up looking for some new fresh faces, and he wanted a group of up-and-comers. And he ended up getting that in spades. Most of the actors he was working with, they were just starting out. This was either their first or their second picture. And most of them would go on to being stock actors who Hill would work with again and again on future projects. If you go back and listen to episode number 41, where we covered Hill's Streets of Fire, you're going to see some of the same names come up there. Hill had wanted to get some seasoned actors in to play the leads, but with such a young cast, he had a bit of a difficulty. Roles for the lead were both offered to actor Tony Danza, who was contractually obligated to keep shooting his television show Taxi, and Robert De Niro, who just flat out turned the project down. Hill had gone back and looked at actors he had seen previously, and he remembered when he was working on the film Alien, he had seen a young actor in a film with Sigourney Weaver at the time, Michael Beck, and he thought he had the charisma and the presence to help carry the film as the de facto leader, Swan, who would be the Xenophon, if you will, of this story. Hill was also drawn to the work of Thomas G. Waits, a, quote, serious Juilliard school-trained actor who had come up with the likes of Christopher Reeve and Robin Williams. Hill had seen Waits' work in the 1978 film On the Yard and thought he would be perfect for the role of Fox, who was going to be fleshed out to being the soul of the gang, an inventive man, person who was going to see this group through, and in the original script was going to keep the group moving as they went through the city of New York. It may have been Swan who inspires and leads them, but it would be the scout Fox who would actually get them home. Hill himself would come to regret this casting choice. For the role of the sole female character and the burgeoning love interest, we'll address that in a moment, Hill was actually set on casting a Puerto Rican actress to play the character of Mercy, but Deborah Val Venkberg ended up coming in after some lobbying from her agents and blew him away. Van Valkenburg actually was in Streets of Fire, if you recall, and she does a very, very great job here. Actor James Remar was brought in for the role of the gang's enforcer Ajax, who got the role by impressing the director literally with his raw strength, creating a working relationship that would end up spanning multiple projects and decades for the two men. For the main villain of the film, Hill cast unknown David Patrick Kelly, a man who had gone to have a very rich career both working with Hill and playing villains and oddball characters in many a film and television show. His general intensity and his ability to ad-lib just stuck out to Hill, and it was something that would come in handy later as he was responsible for that now iconic line, calling the warriors out to fight on the beach. Puerto Rican actor Marcelino Sanchez was cast as the gang's, quote, tag artist, affectionately known to the group as Rembrandt. And for you kids of the 1980s who grew up watching PBS, you'll know him as his role as Ricardo in the reoccurring segments The Bloodhound Gang, which was part of the educational science show 321 Contact that got produced by the Children's Television Workshop. That's an old school favorite of mine. You know, if I didn't have any self-control, I would now do a deep dive on the Bloodhound Gang, but suffice to say, they would solve most of their problems in a very, very simplistic manner by using science. They were mysteries that would make Encyclopedia Brown seem hard-edged, but it was a fabulous thing to watch, and I really did love it. Further tying into the PBS theme, the unseen DJ of this film. Well, that's not completely fair. You see her lips close to the microphone speaking into it during the film. Does that voice strike you as familiar? Well, if you're a kid of the 90s, it should. That's Lynn Thigpen, or as a great deal of us knew her, the Acme Agency Chief from the hit Geography game show.
From Berlin down to Belize, waiting for a ride on a slow bus to China. Tell me where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Actors Paul Greco, Roger Hill, Dorsey Wright, David Harris, Brian Tyler, and Tom McKittrick were all cast to round out the remaining gang members and side characters. And director Hill found himself now dealing with a group of young talent that he thought he could truly utilize as they shot on a truncated schedule over the sweltering spring and summer of 1978. On location in New York, the majority of the shoots being at night in Coney Island, the Bronx, Astoria, Alphabet City, all for a grueling 60 days. Problems developed on set quickly, mainly between Hill and actor Waits. Some attribute it to a riff that first developed in pre-production, where Hill wanted Waits to channel a James Dean style for the role. But in reality, it would be easier to say that Waits was not exactly a team player on set. You see, Waits would clash with the director over everything. The script, the working conditions, the shooting schedule, he hated the night shoots. Waits did end up complaining and got Paramount to provide yet another trailer for the cast to use on the shoot, but it doesn't make up for his tantrums, his arguments, and his walk-offs that Hill had to deal with on a regular basis. Van Valkenburgh's character of Mercy and Fox were supposed to have a romance develop over the course of the film, and be brought together as they shared the challenges of this night of hardship and chase. Waits didn't feel it, and there was zero chemistry on screen between them, which caused Hill to demand that the film be reworked to have Mercy end up now going and falling in love with Swan, with Beck and Van Valkenburgh being far more amenable to working together. After dealing with the bad attitude and fallout over an 8-week period, Hill flat out fired Waits from the shoot. leaving production to have to retcon the entire script to remove all of the Fox character plot points and either eliminate them completely or give them to other characters. Beck's character of Swan was originally going to be kidnapped by another gang. He would break out, of course, but now he needed to be rewritten to stay with the main party of characters all the way through to the end. A stunt coordinator on set was told by Hill that he needed to find a double for Waits because Fox was going to be killed on screen. He's going to get thrown off of a subway platform during a scuffle with a Metro cop and then be run over by a passing train. Waits was very angry when he saw he was being doubled and that his character was being killed off, and he demanded that his name get removed from the production, which it is. Other problems cropped up on set. Van Valkenburg got hurt a few times. Once, when Michael Beck actually misjudged a baseball bat he was throwing, he ended up catching the actress across her face and caused her to have 3 stitches put in. Later, when they were shooting the subway run, where Fox gets killed, the actress was holding on to the stuntman doubling for Fox, and she tripped. She ended up breaking her wrist, which caused the character of Mercy to suddenly be donning a coat for the remainder of the film to hide the fact that she was sporting a cast. Real gang members both threatened to disrupt the shoot and wanted to come on set and fight the actors. They ended up paying the actual gang, the Mongrels, $500 a day to, quote, protect the film trucks while on location, creating a very interesting environment for the film crew, literally having the story of the film being in enemy territory surrounded by hostile forces during the shoot come to life. But all that said, man, oh man, you've been ever so good on all of this, listen to me gas on. How about we get to that trailer?
These are the armies of the night.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
The Furies. The Boppers. The Hi-Hats. The Lizzies. The Turnbull ACs. The Gramercy Riffs.
Riffs! Yeah, right!
And these are the Warriors.
We know about the Warriors. They're a heavy outfit.
They're from Coney Island.
Warriors? You guys are the big dudes, huh?
Now, they're in the Bronx.
We're going back.
27 miles behind enemy lines.
It's the only choice we got.
Between them and safety stand 20,000 cops. And 100,000 sworn enemies.
I want them all. I want all the Warriors.
They've got one way out. They've got one chance. They've got one night. The Warriors.
New York City. Sometime in the near future, the powerful Gramercy Riffs, one of New York's top gangs, led by the powerful charismatic Cyrus, as played by Roger Hill, requests 9 unarmed emissaries from each of the city's top gangs to attend a midnight summit in Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. Cyrus's plan is to unify all of the disparate groups into one powerful alliance that would bring the city to its knees, outnumbering the police 3-1. Led by War Chief Cleon, as played by Dorsey Wright, the Warriors take the subway from their home turf on Coney Island to attend the summer summit. A party that includes Swan, as played by Michael Beck, Ajax, as played by James Remar, Rembrandt is played by Ricardo Sanchez, Cochise is played by David Harris, Cowboy is played by Tom McKitterick, Fox is played by Thomas G. Waits, Snow is played by Brian Tyler, and Vermin is played by Terry Mikos. Upon arrival, they see they are amongst the biggest and most outlandish gangs the city has to offer. The anarchist Turnbull ACs of Gun Hill, the dapper boppers of Harlem, the dangerous baseball furies of Riverside, the rogues from Hell's Kitchen, and the moonrunners of Pelham. To all of these unique groups, Cyrus lays out his vision of what the future could hold.
Can you count, suckers? I say the future is ours! If you can count, now look what we have here before us. We've got the Saracens sitting next to the Jones Street Boys. We've got the Moonrunners right by the Van Cortlandt Rangers. Nobody is wasting nobody. That is a miracle. And miracles is the way things ought to be. You're standing right now with 9 delegates from 100 gangs. And there's over 100 more. That's 20,000 hardcore members. 40,000 counting affiliates. And 20,000 more not organized, but ready to fight. 60,000 soldiers. Now, there ain't but 20,000 police in the whole town. Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
While Cyrus is met with overwhelming applause and support, it is Luther, as played by David Patrick Kelly, the leader of the rogues, who pulls a concealed pistol out and shoots him. Police, who have been waiting and watching, raid the park, and in the ensuing chaos, Luther screams out that he has witnessed the murder, and the warriors are responsible for the death of Cyrus. War Chief Cleon, who is up front, sends the rest of the gang off to run, while he himself is surrounded and beaten to death by angry gang members. Warriors Lieutenant Swan ends up taking charge and tries to lead the group out of the Bronx and back to Coney Island, their home turf and safe territory. Enforcer Ajax is not a fan of this and openly challenges Swan for leadership, but they're forced to run before they can actually settle things.
I only got one question. Who named you leader? I got as much right to take over as you.
It was Cleon's choice, Swan's war chief.
Oh, right about now, Cleon's most likely got a nightstick shoved halfway up his ass. Shit. I bet you can't even find the subway.
Maybe we ought to talk about this later, huh?
Well, what's wrong with right now? I don't want to be warlord.
Make you move.
Hey, Ajax, lighten up.
Big boy, Swan's war chief.
We better stick together.
Hey, you guys! Train's right over there!
Unbeknownst to the warriors, the Gramercy Riffs have taken the rogues' reports to heart, and they have officially put a hit out on the warriors using a coded message that goes out over the radio. All gangs in the city are in the know and are now actively hunting the group of eight as they try to make their way back home to safety.
All right now, for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action, I've been asked to relay a request from the Gramercy Riffs. It's a special for the Warriors. That's that real live bunch from Coney, and I do mean the Warriors. Here's a hit with them in mind.
Hey,
The members get spotted by a busload of armed Turnbull ACs who give the gang chase, forcing them to run up to the elevated train, getting them to temporary safety. That is, until a fire alongside the tracks forces the gang to exit at a random station in Tremont, keeping them still within the limits of the Bronx. Unable to get a direct ride home, they are forced to walk on foot to a different station, crossing through the territory of a lower echelon gang known as the Orphans. Swan, with Fox, ends up requesting a parley with the Orphans' leader, Sully, as played by Paul Greco, and explains that they mean them no disrespect nor hostility. They're just asking for permission to cross their neighborhood to get home.
No matter what he says, nobody lip off. Nobody get hot. I'm gonna see what I can do.
When did you turn into a fucking diplomat?
Yeah, you ain't exactly the State Department type.
Fox, you come with me.
Maybe you ought to show me your invitation.
How do you figure?
Well, you come arming down here, invading our territory. No permits, no parley.
We're not invading. And I'm parleying right now.
We were just at that big meeting up in the Bronx. We're going home to Coney. The train gets messed up by the fire and dumps us here.
I don't know what you're talking about, man. How could this be a big meeting if the Orphans wasn't there?
Listen, you didn't miss anything. There was a lot of hassle, a lot of heads got busted.
Yeah, you think the Orphans ain't with it? You think the Orphans ain't well known?
We didn't say that.
Well, we got a heavy rep. You mess with us and you'll find that out. You see that? They write about our raids in the paper.
Yeah. Hey, that's really heavy. The Orphans, right?
Yeah, a youth worker. She talks about you guys all the time. We ain't got one.
That must be because you guys are so bad, they're afraid of you.
There's nothing wrong with you making it through our territory as long as you're coming in peace.
You know what that is, don't you?
Yeah. Trouble.
Unfortunately, while Sully is indeed enjoying this newfound position of power, a neighborhood girl, Mercy, as played by Van Valkenburg, begins to heckle and insult them, forcing him to suddenly try and get tough with Swan. When Sully insists that the warriors have to remove their colors, i.e. their vests, to cross his territory, and Swan refuses, it's suddenly very apparent to Sully that he and the Orphans are now going to have to fight. And while they're not a very tough gang, they outnumber the 8 members by quite a bit. Rembrandt provides Swan a distraction by way of using a secured Molotov cocktail, allowing the group to set fire to a car nearby, and thus, using that as a distraction, make their escape. Curiously, the smack-talking Mercy follows in tow. The group ends up making its way to the 96th Street subway station in Manhattan, where they have a direct confrontation with the police that ends up splitting them into 2 groups. This leaves Fox dead, with Cochise, Vermin, and Rembrandt on one train, and Swan, Ajax, Snow, and Cowboy running on the streets through Riverside. Out of the darkness, the 4 end up being approached by the Baseball Furies, a gang that paints their faces like members of KISS while wearing knockoff Yankee uniforms, all armed with baseball bats and cleats. A parkside brawl ensues, and the gang is able to outmaneuver their attackers and flee. As they cross the park, Ajax becomes distracted and enamored by a woman sitting on a bench, who tells him that her name is Chloe. And when he decides to get a little fresh with her, she ends up cuffing him to the bench, revealing that she is an undercover police officer, leaving him to be picked up by the NYPD, while the others continue their run back to the train station in an effort to catch up with their comrades. Cochise, Vermin, and Rembrandt are waylaid and then seduced by an all-female gang, the Lizzies, who invite them back to their hangout, buttering them up with praise while secretly calling for reinforcements to come. They attempt to spring an attack on the trio, but they get away, finally learning that they are wanted men, knowing that every gang in the city now is after them. Swan enters the 96th Street station and again finds Mercy there, and also members of the gang, the Punks. In an all-out brawl, Mercy does her part in fighting with the Warriors, proving her loyalty. As they proceed on, they reunite with everyone at Union Station, and they're finally able to catch that one last train home. Now, this entire time, Luther and the Rogues have been aimlessly driving around, causing trouble and attempting to find the Warriors to silence them and preserve their supposed innocence. His own men start to question his judgment, but they're all too afraid of his temper and his clear insanity to object. In the post-bedlam of the meeting, gang members are making their way to the Gramercy Rifts to explain that they saw the Rogues kill Cyrus, not the Warriors. Masai, as played by Edward Seward, is now the acting leader of the Rifts, and he takes a large group with him to head over to Coney Island to personally get to the bottom of this.
We set? We're set, all right. Somebody should pick their ass up. The Rifts sent out the word. They want him alive. We don't.
Soon as someone grabs him, the better.
What's the matter? You afraid the Warriors are gonna shoot their mouths off before they get racked?
Yeah, right. I'm worried. I just don't want the Rifts down on my head.
No sweat. They're looking for the Warriors, remember? We can do some looking, too. Ought to make you feel better.
Hey, what about the money you owe?
What?
After a long night of running and fighting, the Warriors arrive to Coney Island, seeing the beach and the ocean for the first time. Exhausted and happy, the group begins to start to celebrate. That is, until they hear a chilling noise that makes them arm themselves and ready for one last fight.
Stay behind me. I'm gonna take him out to the sand.
What about you? You ready?
Let's do it.
Luther and the Rogues are there, ready to kill. Preparing themselves for one last confrontation, the group tiredly walks out onto the beach to meet the Rogues. Swan asks Luther point blank why he did all this. Why did he kill Cyrus? Why did he blame them? Luther just laughs and said, "No reason. I just like doing things like that." As Swan squares off to fight Luther one-on-one, the Rogue's warlord pulls the gun, telling him he's dead. Swan throws a switchblade that he's secured into Luther's arm, having him shoot wild and dropping his pistol. Luther falls to his knees, and Swan walks up to him and removes the knife from his arm, wiping the blood on his hair, and then stepping back to await the Rogue's next move. As Rogue members raise chains and weapons, the two groups are startled by the sudden appearance of 40-something odd members of the Gramercy Riffs, who have been observing this entire scene. Masai strolls down to the beach and compliments the warriors, telling him they have now found what they're looking for. The warriors stroll off into the breaking dawn on the beach while the Riffs encircle the rogues, and Luther screams in vain. As the gang continues their walk on the shore, the DJ comes back on and apologizes to the warriors, calling off their hunt and honoring them with a song. Joe Walsh's In the City plays, and credits roll. So where do we even begin? I mean, okay, let's face it. For a modern adaptation of a Greek epic war story, for my money, this ain't too shabby. Does it have its problems? Oh, for sure. A glaring one would be the absolute whitewashing of its main characters. Yes, the warriors are indeed a mixed-race gang. That part's actually fine. But glaringly so, the white members, more than anybody else, are in charge. And by taking away the component of it being a minority gang, and cutting out actual the social commentary of why the young men are in this gang, and what it means to them, their bad lives at home, their struggles to fit in, they've essentially swapped out all of the redeeming aspects and social commentary of Yurik's pulp novel, and instead they've stripped it down and transmuted it into a nice, bland studio action film. Don't get me wrong, it's a film I love, but it does feel like sort of a waste of an adaptation in a certain light. Something that makes this film both iconic and silly at the same time, and the part that actually divides people, is the gangs themselves. Now, over the years, I've found that there are those who take it for what it is and run with it. People like me. They enjoy the crazy outfits, they enjoy the themes, and the posturing done by the various gangs that we encounter through the course of the film. The karate gis that are worn by the Gramercy Riffs, the kiss makeup and the baseball uniforms of the Furies, the roller skates and crazy suspenders of the Punks. All of it is its own rich and interesting cultural touch, one that production actually worked very hard on to make unique. A collective sort of individualism, if you will. Yet there's other people, people like my wife, who will walk through the room and just comment, "What clown gang are they fighting now?" You just can't please everyone. But stylistically, this film, I will say, was ahead of the curve. The transitions, turning the pages like a comic book, taking scenes if one were looking at the actual panel of a comic book and then bringing it to life, that was pretty revolutionary for the day. And it's a motif that holds up quite well over 40 years on. One thing that Hill truly wanted to do but was actually unable to accomplish was, at least during the film's theatrical run, because of budget reasons and because the studio flat out didn't like the concept, what he wanted to do was start the movie with a splash panel opening that would involve a narrator. In Hill's mind, he thought the stern, authoritative voice of Orson Welles explaining briefly the story of Anabasis in a colorful comic panel slide would be a great transition into the film as we currently know it. Hill was shot down, but he was finally able to correct this with his 2005 director's cut of the film, where they did just that, with Hill voicing the narration and setting up the story that he wanted to tell. And honestly, in the context of relating it back to Xenophon, I think it's a marvelous touch. So I guess the thing to start with is, how was the film actually received? As a box office draw, it did quite well. Culturally, it debuted with problems, however. You see, it was released February 9th of 1979, and it did exactly what it set out to do. It beat the Wanderers as it had hoped. And the Warriors saw real box office success. A movie that, with the adjusted cost, was about a little over $4 million to make, ended up raking in a respectable $22.5 million after its initial theatrical run. Critics at the time, though, were not pleased with it. They compared it to exploitative biker films from the 60s, arguing that it was unrealistic, all flash, no substance. Some accused it of glorifying gang life, noting it would cause problems for law enforcement in real life. Favorite punching bags of mine, and hey, I'll say it again, I grew up with them in Chicago, so you go after what you know. Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel did not find this to be a good film offering from Walter Hill. Ebert himself noted in his review this was just a ballet of stylized male violence, although in the same sentence he notes that it isn't remotely intended to be an action film, so which is it, Roger? Is it an action film that has no action but violence? I don't think he really understood the comic book nature of its framing, and the rotund critic would go on to state that The Warriors takes that style to such an extreme that almost all life and juice are drained from it. When the characters talk, they seem to be inhabiting a tale rehearsed many times before. My slip of the tongue aside, I don't know, possibly an epic story that's about 1581 years old at the time it was filmed. Yeah, it's probably been rehearsed a few times. Siskel himself was a little more fascist in his thinking, as was his way, noting in his review that one would think that gang membership is simply a victimless crime. Yeah, whatever. You know, on the surface, the reviews didn't matter. The harder blow would be that author Yorick was upset about how his novel was translated to the silver screen. Feeling that it was appealing to teens as wish fulfillment, but instead of giving insight to their feelings and their worldview, the takeaway instead was adults were just going to fear, quote, the demonic uprising of a lumpen youth. There were other problems, though. You see, like we said, the film was aimed at teens. It's about teenage gang members. It's popular. And thus, young teens who happen to be gang members themselves would want to go see it, where they would interact with other rival gang members in theaters, which caused fighting and violence and honestly a couple deaths. Or as Paramount PR would refer to it, incidents during the course of watching the film. Terrified that they would lose out on their investment, Paramount quickly pivoted in its marketing of the picture, markedly reducing the number of ads it was taking out for the film, changing them so it made no mention about what the film was really about. On the whole, though, I have to say this reaction was rather overblown. Let me put it this way. Salon.com did an interview back in 2005 for the re-release of the film, and Michael Beck, who played Swan, ended up sharing a story that President Reagan had reached out to him personally back in 1980, telling the actor that he had watched the film and just wanted to share how much he had enjoyed it when he screened it at Camp David. Now, this is Ronald Reagan. He was no fan of things that would be regarded as being against law and order or the status quo. So I would argue if that former president is on board and on your side and says the film's good, you did just fine. The Warriors has remained a cult video rental favorite for years, but upon the 2005 re-release of the director's cut, a bunch of video games, action figures, and costumes followed. Talk has been going on for the last 15 years or so of doing a remake, with now-deceased director Tony Scott being the first to plan on a version of his own. At least that was before he passed back in 2012. I would argue the film does not need to be remade. If you try to make it a modern film, make it realistic, you take away all that stylizedness, all the comic book elements that set it in the context of an epic adventure in the first place. Seriously, they want to take away the costumes. If you guys are taking away that myth element, you're removing the fun and the magic from the story. What you're then left with is just a film about guys fighting. And while I'm no, you know, prude to violence, I can watch plenty of other things to get my fist fight fix. The genius directors, the Russo brothers, have announced couple years back, they wanted to bring a Warriors TV series to one of the streaming services. But thus far, none of that's come to fruition. And, well, again, I appreciate their skill, and I think they could have probably done some really interesting things. Please, leave this one alone. This film doesn't need to have an actual update. The version of the Warriors screened here at the LSCE was the 2005 Ultimate Director's Cut DVD. And that comes with some really nice extras. A full introduction by director Walter Hill, 4 making-of featurettes that get into the behind-the-scenes struggles with casting, filming, and a retrospective look at the picture, as well as the full theatrical trailer. All of this could be yours on DVD for what I'm going to call a sliding range. You see, Amazon's actually been weird on this one. The Blu-ray of the same Ultimate Edition is $7.99. The DVD of the same Ultimate Edition is $8.99. Same features, different formats. But for those of you that are looking for a bargain, that same DVD can be acquired, at least as of this recording's date, from your local Target or Walmart for the flat rate of $5, which I would say is well worth the price for something so fun and so iconic. Now, remember folks, just want to point out, we don't get anything here at the LSCE for telling you where and or who to purchase your items from. We just think it's very important to continue to support physical media so that these fine companies that own the rights to all these wonderful films with all of their content will continue to release it. And at the end of the day, isn't that what it's about? Seeing the things you want to see? Getting to have those films you love and like back on the screen. Besides, The Warriors is a fantastic cult film and one that everyone should be exposed to and get a chance to see properly. So I say to you, what are you waiting for? Go out there, get yourself a copy today. So that's going to wrap things up here for this episode of I Saw It on Linden Street. Thank you so much for joining us. If you like us, again, please give us a favorable review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe. Swing by, check out our website, that's lscep.com. We have articles, episode links, and comics for you to peruse. We're also featured on Podchaser, that's a podcast database for listeners and creators alike. Find us there, give us a follow, you can review us there too if you please. The more reviews and the more subscribers makes us more searchable, and then we can share with more people. And hey, isn't that the goal? We'll grow the brand, we'll talk about more movies, and we'll get to do more things with you, the listeners. As always, I will maintain, if you would like to get in touch with us, make a comment, ask a question, send us wonderful things, please feel free, reach out, email us at lindenstreetcinemaexperience@gmail.com. If you'd like to be even more personal or wish to contribute a segment to the sidecar, please send your audio messages to us by way of Anchor. That's a free and easy app for you to use. So, until next time, please take care out there, everybody. Stay healthy, wash your hands, wear a mask, be well, and remember, life's too short not to live in the past. Take it easy, everybody.